Welcome back to another episode of Diagnosing a Killer, the Mental Breakdown.
Having a breakdown. Having a fucking breakdown.
At this moment, right now, actively having a breakdown.
How are you doing?
I just came back from a week being out of town, and I've been home for like a couple of hours, and you and I really haven't talked a lot, so this is like our first time talking in like a week in person.
So funny too, because I was riding around the car, and I was like, I miss my sister, and then you come home and like barely even spoken to each other.
Well, just having the presence. Mm-hmm. It was a lot of fun, but I was really ready to be home. I was just in a... you know, four-person RV, which is great, but that couch is very uncomfortable to sleep on.
It is.
For more than, like, 2 days, and I was there for, like, five nights, so.
Yeah.
But, happy to be home, happy to be here recording for you guys.
Yay!
Thanks again for 50,000 plus downloads. Super excited about that. I do have just a couple of messages to read, but if there's anyone here for the first time, would you like to give them our social media handles?
Sure, you can check us out on social media, anywhere at Diagnosing a Killer, other than X, formerly known as Twitter, which is at Killer Diagnosis. We also have a PayPal, Venmo, and Cash App, all at Diagnosing a Killer. Our email is diagnosingakiller@gmail.com. I don't think we say that often enough. We're like,
email us.
And it's like,
what the hell's your email?
What's your email? And then, of course, Patreon. We also have one of those. Tier 2 and 3 Patreon members get an exclusive, unedited, essentially, for the most part, and ad-free and no content warning episode, a bonus episode every month. And our Tier 1 Patreon members, that is the $5 one, you also get ad-free every month as well, or every week, excuse me.
Twice a week. Awesome. Yeah, so we do have a good mental breakdown for you guys today, but before we get into that, I do just have a couple of messages to read.
Ooh.
You haven't read these either yet, so Mm-mm. This is going to be new to you. We do have a new listener of ours that chose to remain anonymous, but they messaged and said, "Hey, you two, I'm a new listener, and I immediately did a deep dive. After like 2 weeks of casual listening, I listened to you all on my 14-hour drive to pick up a family member from mental health treatment yesterday."
Wow.
"You're so funny and open-minded, and I really appreciate all of the research and work you do. I've always been a true crime fan, and obviously mental illness / health topics are close to my heart, so this podcast is such a perfect fit for me. Also, when I realized the two of you are sisters, I immediately recommended you to my sister. Anyway, rambly, but I just wanted to let you know how much I appreciate you all and all you do. Love you, bye!"
Love you, bye. Thanks, Anon.
Yeah, such a nice message. We just love hearing from everyone, all of our listeners.
Yeah.
So it's great to hear how, especially the mental health aspect mm-hmm. of the podcast, is really affecting people in a positive way.
Yes. And happy and healthy vibes to your family member as well.
Absolutely. And then we just have another message as well from a listener, Tara. Tara said, "Just found this podcast and I'm obsessed. You two are freaking hilarious. Reminds me of myself and my sister who I lost in 2016, mm-hmm. but still brings a smile to my face. We always said, that's a big old bitch." Which cracks me up.
That's funny.
She goes on, "Much love and support from Seattle, Washington, home of the Green River Killer, a.k.a. Gary Woodridge."
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
So yeah, awesome too. I responded and said, you know, Kenna's going to Seattle in, you know, a couple months, and she's really excited about it. It's just cool, when, especially when people tell us where they're from. I love that, because we have listeners in places that we don't think we do, you know?
Yes. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, we still have imposter syndrome.
Thank you all so much for writing in. We really appreciate it. It super brightens our day.
Absolutely. Okay, are we going to get into this mental breakdown?
First, I think that we should mention the True Crime Paranormal Podcast Festival happening in July, the 12th through the 14th. That's Kenna's birthday weekend in Denver, Colorado. Get your tickets and use our code DAKPOD.
Just DAK.
Oh, just DAK for that 15% off of your tickets.
Yes. super, super excited about that. It's coming up way faster than we know it.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like we just found out we were invited to 2023's TCPF.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
And now we're almost about to go to our second one.
Yeah.
With all of our friends.
With our friends.
This year we have people we know. We have friends walking into it. So yeah, definitely get those tickets. And they actually just announced that there's going to be a almost like a stand-up comedy act there this year, which is really cool. Yeah, stand-up like comedy and true crime.
Yeah, true crime comedy stand-up.
Yes.
I think it sounds really interesting. It's going
to
be fun.
We're definitely going to have to make time for that.
Yes.
All right. So for this week's mental breakdown, we are going to be talking about phantom limb pain. Your face just lit up.
Shocked.
Yes.
Okay, all right.
Phantom limb pain. If you don't know what it is, you are in for a good episode. Informational episode. Content warning. This episode includes talk of amputation and other disabilities relating to physical pain. If this episode is not for you, we encourage you to find another one of our episodes. Remember, your mental health is very important, and we love you.
We love you.
Bye. So yes, phantom limb pain, I'm going to say interchangeably phantom limb pain and just phantom pain, just for sake of brevity.
Okay.
It is defined as a painful perception that an individual experiences related to a limb or an organ that is not physically part of the body because it was removed or was never there in the first place.
Okay, so I've mostly heard of it described, like, by amputees.
Yes.
But organs, too. That's interesting.
Very interesting. And it can be also used interchangeably with terms such as phantom eye pain, if your eye were to be removed. Yes.
Oh.
Phantom pain is typically reported following the amputation of a limb, but may also occur during the removal of a breast, tongue, or even internal organ, such as a kidney.
That's so true, yeah. Now that I think about it, yeah, that makes sense. That you would feel, like, even a breast reduction, I've heard that you're, like, so used to holding your arms a certain way or something, and it's like you just, your body is so used to that feeling, and that you just can still, it's like a residual feeling.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. The pain duration, sensation, and frequency varies from person to person. The pain can last for seconds, hours, days, or even longer, depending on the situation. While phantom limb pain has been reported to affect an estimated 8 out of 10 people who lose a limb, it is not to be confused with residual limb pain.
Oh, okay. So that's what I was saying. Yeah, residual instead of pain. Yeah.
Residual limb pain affects the remaining part of the limb where the amputation occurred and is usually the result of a medical complication such as nerve damage or pressure on remaining nerves.
I see.
So just quickly differentiating the two, residual limb pain is at the site of amputation and phantom limb pain can essentially feel like it's farther away from that site.
I see. So, okay, okay.
That's where the limb used to be.
Instead of the nerves at the base of the amputation. Okay.
Residual limb pain is estimated to affect 7 in 10 people with limb loss. So just one less than estimated for.
You said 7 in 10?
Yes, as opposed to 8 in 10 for phantom limb pain. Although the two types of pain are different from each other, it is important for professionals to be able to distinguish which one is which, because treatment plans and or medication will vary depending on the type of pain. Additionally, these two types of pain can also occur at the same time.
Oh,
just
really?
Just keep that in mind, yes.
Okay.
In the United States, 1.7 million people live with limb loss each year, and there are approximately 185,000 new lower extremity amputations that occur each year.
Wow.
That's just lower extremity.
Yeah.
Although amputations have occurred for centuries, the first phantom pain sensation was recorded in the 16th century on French military soldier patients.
Whoa.
This was first recorded in 1551 by French military surgeon, is it ambrosia? Is that how you say that?
Ambrosia salad.
I looked it up and they're both spelled the same. So yes, ambrosia. Paré. Sorry, I don't do well with French. He would report that, quote, "For the patients, long after the amputation is made, say that they still feel pain in the amputated part," end quote. So again, that was 1551.
And it's not to say like things like that didn't exist then, but it's just interesting knowing when the first recorded instances of it was.
In the 19th century, similar symptoms would first become identified as phantom limb pain. This term was first coined by American neurologist Silas Weir Mitchell in 1871. He would describe that, quote, Thousands of spirit limbs were haunting as many good soldiers, ever now and then tormenting them, end quote.
Fucking Heaves.
Yeah.
That, what a way to say that.
What a way to describe that. Yeah. Because now it's like, okay, now we know it's like a neurological thing. You know, it could be the nervous system, but he was like, nope. Haunted limbs.
Spirit limbs.
Yes.
Oh, oh my God.
Following an amputation, the onset of phantom limb pain most often occurs soon after surgery. This pain can feel like a variety of things, such as twisting, itching, pressure, or burning, which sounds very painful. Following recovery, there are many things that can cause phantom limb pain to reoccur or occur for the first time. These triggers include things such as simple touch, sexual activity, exposure to cold temperatures, cigarette smoking, changes in barometric pressure, and even simply using the restroom.
Well, that's all, like, nerves, right? Yeah. It's all your nervous system.
Exactly.
That's interesting.
People can be often reluctant to express that they are experiencing this pain to anybody, most likely due to the fear that they will be seen as crazy.
Hmm.
You know, that limb's not there. You know, there's no way you could feel it.
Yeah. And, like, but again, it's one of those things, it's like, how do you convince someone that it's not in their head?
Exactly.
You can't. Like...
However, it is much more common than people think, and telling one's primary care provider as soon as it happens is key to getting effective treatment.
Hmm.
Phantom limb pain is most commonly felt in the parts of the body that are farthest away, such as toes and fingers, and less common on amputations of, say, a leg or an arm, although this can occur as well. Not sure exactly why that is, but it's like maybe because it's like you can see it more often because it's farther away from you.
Yeah.
As opposed to having it maybe on your shoulder.
Right. Where you don't always, it's like you can never not see your nose in the front of your face.
Thanks for
it's
that.
There. It's always there. It just
now
makes
I'm going
to look
at my research at my nose.
Cross-eyed. Yeah. I think you're right. I think because we have such an association of looking down at our hands when we're doing something that's probably more prominent in your brain.
It's almost like an out of sight, out of mind kind of thing. So what causes phantom limb pain? And I'm going to ask everyone to bear with me because there is a lot of medical terminology coming up and I'm going to try my hardest to pronounce it correctly.
I love when we have episodes like this because you're the one that always challenges yourself. I'll find another way to say it.
I'm like, I can read. I can do this. So originally, phantom pain was thought to occur due to neuromas located at the amputation site. A neuroma is typically a tumor or a tissue that develops as a result of amputation.
Hmm.
However, it seems to be more neurological and having to do with the nervous system. While experts believe that phantom pain results from a mix-up in the nervous system signals, specifically between the spinal cord and brain, there are many different theories of why this occurs.
Hmm.
So the first theory we're going to talk about is called peripheral mechanisms.
Okay.
Kind of sounds like, if you know, out of sight, out of mind. If you can see it, it
is
likely to happen. This theory states that the neuromas formed at the amputation site show increased sodium expression, and because of this, an increased activity of fibers is caused. Just various fibers. These fibers are involved in pain and temperature sensation and can contribute to phantom pain. However, it has been noted that the pain decreased once the fibers were able to be calmed down with blocking agents, so this theory is not widely believed to be the full reason behind phantom pain.
Hmm.
The next theory is spinal mechanisms. Peripheral nerve injury can lead to the degeneration of fibers in the spinal cord, and when this happens, a different type of fiber can branch into the same area. If this happens, the secondary fibers can be turned into noxious stimuli.
What?
So not good.
AKA not good.
This is kind of hard to explain, but essentially, if these types of fibers become noxious, it can cause the original ones to do the same, and this can lead to what is known as central sensitization.
Hmm.
Central sensitization can affect the nervous system, especially at areas that have had trauma to them. However, patients with complete spinal cord injury have also experienced phantom pain, so experts theorize that there must be an underlying central mechanism within the brain.
That's very interesting.
I know. These things are so cool to me. Like nerding out over here.
So this is like essentially all the reasons why it couldn't be physical, but why it's neurological.
Yes. Or it's like, these are like, some people believe these theories, but then there's like limitations to the theory. Like some people are like, well, no, that couldn't be the whole case because of this.
Right.
The next theory is called central mechanisms. In much of the 20th century, it was believed that no new central circuits could be formed in the adult brain. However, experiments from the 1980s onward would cast doubt into this thought. In one example of this, functional MRI studies in amputees have shown that almost all patients have experienced cortical remapping, or a new cortical map growing after damage. Something in the brain. I'm not going to go into explaining that.
It makes sense. Like, remapping, it's like you're having to retrain your brain on how to reconfigure, like, everyday tasks, you know? Like, just what you now know are your capabilities, right?
Exactly. I hope everyone's following. I know some of these words. Even when I was reading, I was like, oh my gosh, how am I going to explain this in, like, layman's terms? Yeah.
It's like having to learn how to write again or how to speak again.
Exactly. Yeah. This theory goes further to state that after amputation, cortical remapping leads to areas of the brain formerly receiving input from the lost limb now able to be stimulated from the nearby cortical regions, thus phantom pain. Hmm. So it's like it's trying to connect with that part that's no longer there, and it's like getting essentially like frustrated and hurting.
Yeah.
A limitation to this theory, however, would be that it has been shown mostly in upper extremity amputations and less in lower ones.
Hmm.
It can also be found that the more severe the amputation, the higher the amount of cortical reorganization will occur, suggesting that if the amputation was from birth, this theory may not stand.
Yeah.
Finally, the neuromatrix theory is widely accepted as a reason behind phantom pain. In this theory, initially coined by psychologist Ronald Melzack in the 1990s, there is an extensive network connecting the thalamus, which is the large mass of gray matter in the central brain, and the cortex, which provides direction for the rest of the body, as well as the cortex and the limbic system being linked together. The limbic system is a set of brain structures that surround either side of the thalamus. So they're all kind of in the same area.
Mm. But underneath, essentially, like, the top hemispheres. So it's within, like, kind of behind your ocular cavity, but more deeper in.
Pretty centralized in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
The main suggestion behind this theory is that since all of these things are linked and can tell each other how to react to stimuli, there is a genetically predetermined network that will tell the body things that were once there are still there. This theory goes on to suggest that certain activities associated with pain will lead to the conscious perception of phantom pain, such as maybe boiling water coming towards where your hand would be, and your brain recognizes, oh my gosh, like, that's painful.
I burned myself.
Yes. Yeah. After limb amputation, changes to the neuromatrix and neurosignature may be the cause of the phantom pain localized in the lost limb. Support for this theory is largely due to studies that show chordotomy failed to treat phantom pains. Chordotomy is a surgical procedure that essentially blocks certain nerves from receiving signals and therefore should stop pain from being localized to certain areas, like a spinal block or something.
So it's essentially just, it's kind of interesting because they're experiencing this pain, but the medication they're taking is kind of for the pain, but it's specifically to numb it.
Yeah, it like tricks the nervous system into thinking that nerve is like dead, so now you can't feel the pain.
Yeah, and it's interesting that these are, you know, like you said, blockers, but they're pain medication?
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting.
I hope everyone's following me. Like I said, this is definitely something that took me a while to kind of siphon out, you know, the best way to explain it.
When I think about the latest trends, I think Spencer's. Spencer's has been a mall must-visit since its first store opened in 1963. From then, Spencer's has always stocked the most unique and buzzworthy products, including but not limited to their wide range of lava lamps, their body jewelry cases, and of course their infamous wallet wall. And don't forget about their 18 and up section, dedicated to sexual health. Did I mention their humanitarian work? Spencer's has been partnered with the ACLU for years in an effort to protect individual rights, as well as other nonprofits such as cancer. With over 670 locations in the US, Spencer's is the hottest place for trends, even after 75 years. Click the link in the show notes to receive an exclusive offer today. Spencer's, life's a party, and we're making it fun.
So limitations to this theory come from its failure to explain why relief from phantom pain after treatment rarely eliminates it altogether, and how some people's sensations can spontaneously end, while others will not have phantom pain at all.
Yeah.
So again, those are the most widely believed theories for why phantom pain exists.
That's incredible.
We're going to keep going. While phantom pain is a clinical diagnosis, it is based on the signs and symptoms an individual describes. This being the case, there are no specific laboratory studies or imaging findings that support its diagnosis. It's essentially like self-reported pain that the doctor just kind of has to be like, okay, that sounds like phantom pain.
This, yeah.
However, of course, the doctor will perform a thorough exam to make sure this is the case before providing treatment, because sometimes things like residual limb pain or phantom pain can be caused by a misfitted prosthetic or something like that. When it comes to treatment for phantom pain, it is important that the doctor understands the severity of the pain and the history behind the amputation. One type of treatment that may seem logical is medication. Doses of pain meds needed usually drop substantially when combined with other types of treatment, but are rarely discontinued completely. So essentially, if you get on medication for it, you're probably going to be on it forever.
Really?
Yes.
So this isn't like something you can like, I don't want to say like seek therapy for, but you know, like physical therapy or anything like that.
It just depends. It's really a case-to-case basis from what I've read. And, you know, sometimes it'll spontaneously go away on its own, like with no treatment.
And that's so interesting.
And that's why there's all these different types of treatment, because it gives you a bunch of options to try, you know, before you have to do, you know, I'll get to it, but essentially the last resort treatment for it.
And I'm sure that every case is different because the individual is different.
Yes.
Their life experiences are different. The way that they process things are different. And not only that, but probably no two surgeries are exactly the same either.
Exactly.
So you're going to have nerve pain and such as well.
For sure. I mean, you could even go as far to say, is that having to do with the experience of the doctor? You know, the doctor could potentially make a mistake if they're still new to these types of procedures and leave that nerve damage behind.
Yeah. Certain cauterizations, all that other stuff as well.
So going back to medication, antiepileptics such as gabapentin, pregabalin and topiramate have shown mixed results in clinical studies for treating phantom pain.
Good job.
Thank you. I'm really trying. Tricyclic antidepressants, such as amitriptyline, are often used to relieve chronic pain and recently have been used more often in an attempt to reduce phantom limb pain. I put PLP, so it took me a second. Other medications, such as ketamine, are thought to work by reversing the process of central sensitization within the spinal cord and have been proposed as possible preventative for the development of phantom limb pain.
They also give that to cats.
Well, ketamine is also a drug that people abuse.
Yeah.
It's like a horse tranquilizer.
Ketamine.
Terrible. It was, it's called Special K.
Special
Not
K.
Not that I know. I've
Isn't
heard.
That the Kellogg cereal too, right? Isn't that called Special K?
I think so.
That's cute.
Although the use of ketamine has been shown to reduce phantom limb pain, memantine, a similar medication, did not provide any benefit to patients. So, again, not really proven to work.
Mm-hmm.
Lastly, pain relief may also be achieved through use of opioids, calcitonin, and lidocaine.
Woo!
Bam!
You got it.
I did it. Another treatment that may be beneficial in treating phantom limb pain is what is known as mirror therapy. I'm sure you've heard of this.
I watch Grey's Anatomy, too.
So I know. I was just thinking that.
Love
Arizona Robbins.
Yes.
This type of therapy was first invented in the 1990s by neuroscientist Valainer S. Ramachandran.
That didn't sound French.
I'm not sure exactly the origin of the name, but it was hard to pronounce. In this type of therapy, individuals place their opposite, intact limb in front of a mirror and voluntarily move the limb, giving them the visual sight that their absent limb is also moving.
Mm-hmm.
This allows for illusions of movement and touch in a phantom limb by essentially tricking the brain into thinking the limb is still there. This type of therapy is beneficial for patients who experience phantom limb pain due to a clenching feeling and not being able to unclench or relax the phantom limb, almost like Charlie horse.
Yeah.
The theory behind this type of phantom limb pain is that the phantom limb feels paralyzed because there's no feedback from the phantom limb back to the brain to inform it otherwise. Ramachandran believed that if the brain could receive visual feedback that the phantom limb had moved, it would become unparalyzed, so to speak.
Hmm.
Use of mirror theory has been shown to be effective in some cases, but there's still no widely accepted theory of how it works.
It's all gotta be, like, you know, psychological.
It has to be.
Right?
And that's why I wanted to do this, because it's, like, it's not only physical. Like, it is really, I think, psychological.
Yeah.
In a 2017 study on mirror therapy, it was reported that patients were able to get relief from phantom limb pain on average for 4 weeks following the therapy.
Hmm.
However, only about 15 true studies have been done on mirror therapy since it became known in the 90s.
Yeah.
So it's really not a lot of information.
That was like yesterday.
Yes. What was it?
I know. I just like to say it because it makes me feel better.
Yes. Same. Current theories on how mirror therapy works have come from studies investigating changes in the brain via MRI. However, the mystery still stands as to how it works. Hmm. Another type that I'll just pepper in here is called graded motor imagery. It's essentially the same thing as mirror therapy. I don't really even know the difference. It's just, it's a different, like, healing time, essentially, is what they try to suggest. But yeah. This is so new, it's just, like, there's not a lot of information on it.
Interesting.
But I just wanted to pepper that in there.
Pepper that in.
The next type of treatment is motor execution with biofeedback.
And that doesn't sound good.
It doesn't sound good, but it's actually kind of cool. This is a newer therapeutic intervention that takes advantage of VR, virtual reality. Patients wear VR goggles that allow them to visualize their phantom limb as intact. They are also able to participate in certain games or activities such as grasping an object or kicking a ball with their phantom limb.
Wow.
During this type of treatment, it is thought that essentially a match between the visual and somatosensory systems occurs, which may lead to decreased pain. Numerous case studies have shown positive outcomes, but the treatment type is still needing much more supporting evidence to back up its strength. Lastly, deep brain simulation is a surgical technique and used to treat phantom limb pain. This is typically reserved for when the patient has tried most other options, as this is clearly an invasive treatment plan. Patients will first undergo PET and MRI scans prior to surgery to determine approximate trajectory of where the pain is localized. This surgery is carried out only under a local anesthetic, as the patient needs to be able to provide feedback during surgery.
Oh, hell no.
So awake brain surgery, apparently.
Hell no.
The doctor would essentially place stimulatory electrodes in different parts of the brain until the patient says that their pain is at an all-time low. This is the spot where a permanent electrode would then be placed.
Wow, that's fucking incredible.
It's so cool, right? Following this, the patient would be put under general anesthesia, where the doctor would implant a pulse generator in their chest.
Oh my gosh.
So from what I can tell, and if anyone knows, correct me if I'm wrong, from what I can tell, it seems like the patient is then forward instructed to push on or manipulate that device when they feel pain to signal the electrode to, like, start working.
Okay, that
in
makes...
the brain. Because it doesn't, it's not just all the time.
Right.
So, pretty crazy.
But that's really fucking cool.
Yeah.
That's, oh my gosh. I said what I said where I was like, oh, hell no. But, you know, at the same time, like, if that's your everyday fucking life, bring it on.
Hell
like,
yeah.
To get rid of this pain that just doesn't go away. Oh my gosh, I can't even imagine.
I think I would do it.
I probably would too. As much as I said.
Oh, hell no.
I was like, can you put the video camera up so I can watch you do it?
Yeah. Oh no, I wouldn't want to see that.
That's me.
So we're different than that. When I get like a tattoo or like my blood drawn or something, I have to look away and you're like staring at it. I'm like, how do you do that?
I have to. It's more of like a, it is kind of like a mind over matter for me. I think that as long as I know how something works, I'm less afraid of it. So I definitely, like, I remember getting some of my teeth drilled when I was like 15 or 16 years old, and they tried to put the mask on me, the laughing gas and stuff, and I felt too weird, and I was like, I don't want to do that, and our doctor at the time was like, well, let me at least numb you with some Novocaine. I was like, no, just raw dog it.
Ugh, no, thank you.
I was more like,
Novocaine me up.
At least let me know, like, how painful it is, then I'll let you know if I can handle it.
I don't like that.
Yeah.
You're weird.
So go in there and just dig around in my brain.
In a study on the effectiveness of deep brain stimulation, all patients had pain relief following the surgery. However, while the intensity of pain decreased by over 50%, it was not eliminated altogether. So those are the available treatment options thus far. So when it comes to prevalence, phantom limb pain is estimated to be as high as 80% among amputees.
Wow.
It is more commonly observed in adults, with less commonly being seen in young amputees or people who were born missing limbs.
Do you think that's because, well, of course, like, a birth defect would be different. That's how you grow up. And in children, do you think it's that children are, like, malleable, if that makes sense? Like, they're able to, like, reprogram I think so. Part of their brain.
I also think that it has to do with, like, physical development. And a lot of kids experience, like, growth pains in general. Yeah. So they might not even recognize it to be that. They might just think it's a normal, I don't know. Like, I got growing pains all the time when I was getting older. Yeah. Not to say that they're the same thing, but.
No, but that does make sense, though, that, like, you're just, babies are, and children are just so resilient, you know? I mean, I unfortunately have an acquaintance of mine that said that her sister got into a really bad car accident, but her sister's only 20, and it's like, she's going to be okay, you know?
Yeah.
She's going to be able to mend those bones and still be able to, you know, not get over it, but, you know, be able to go through the physical therapy. And I think, yeah, especially when you're in your late 20s or 30s or 40s, it's got to be way more difficult.
For sure. I mean, even at, like, mid-20s, you know, I had surgery when I was 26, and it took me, shit, almost a year to be able to run. I had hip surgery, and it was very minimally invasive.
Yeah.
But I was, like, scared to run for almost a year because I didn't want to hurt myself because, like, I feel like it just took that long.
Yeah. Also, it makes sense, like, if you're, like, 4 or 5,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah. For sure. And also, I'm sure that kids just don't report symptoms as often as adults do, and that's why this probably is the case.
Kids are always going to want to run around with the other kids, right? So mm-hmm.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I've said it, like, 12 times this episode. Sorry, y'all.
Exactly.
So studies have shown that there are potential things people can do to prevent phantom limb pain from occurring in the first place. The first one is pre-amputation pain reduction. This suggests that high pain levels before an amputation are associated with phantom limb pain, and that focusing on pain management before one's amputation may help reduce the risk. Mm. Of course, this is for planned amputations. You can't plan some of them.
Right.
Secondly is pre-amputation counseling. This can be helpful in lowering phantom limb pain levels if the patient receives therapy prior to the amputation. Different types of anesthesia are also linked with lower phantom limb pain chances. Phantom pain is linked to general anesthesia, and the risk is actually lower with different types of anesthesia, such as a nerve block. And lastly, depression management after an amputation or removal of a body part is a way to lower the risk of phantom pain. Unfortunately, like I said, there are circumstances in which you cannot prepare for an amputation, so these pre-planned things are not necessarily helpful. However, speaking with a professional following an amputation, planned or not, is beneficial to one's mental health.
Yeah, I would agree. It's got to be really difficult to go through something like that and then just kind of deal with these pains or phantom pains on your own. And just, I don't know, there's got to be a lot of, you know, guilt or feelings of inadequacy or, you know, feeling like, you know, I can't speak for somebody's experience, but yeah, just overall melancholia, honestly, and just feeling lamaze. Well, it's gonna be hard to, like, again, retrain your brain to do new things.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And I think that this is, I mean, it's very true for everybody, but especially when an amputation kind of affects one's ability to do what they've done in the past, like, let's say an athlete,
mm-hmm.
You know, our grandfather was a race car driver in his early 20s, and he had a really bad accident that cost him his arm at the elbow.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I know, he didn't race after that because of it, or...
I don't think he really did. I think he did a few, but he had a very successful career in HVAC.
He did.
And he was, you know, crawling around in the attics and stuff with a prosthetic. He loved the hook. The hook was his favorite.
The hook was awesome.
He, many, many years later, they were like, we can give you one with, like, fingers and shit. And he's like, hell no. Like, no. I don't want that. I like the way that this is. I don't want to have to relearn.
Yeah.
But what's interesting about that is I was thinking about that, of course, throughout this episode. And I wish that maybe we had asked him questions about his experience with any phantom limb pain, if he had any.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, it's not something that I really knew about until I was, you know, I mean, honestly, until, like, a couple of years ago, you know. Yeah. I didn't really have experience with that. And it was just so normal to see our grandpa with a prosthetic, you know, that was our everyday life. And it didn't occur to me to ask questions because there was, in my mind, you know, there wasn't anything missing, you know.
Right. And I never remember ever feeling like that, being like, oh, like, it's strange, you know, it was never strange. And it would be like only when a friend would bring it up. Oh, your grandpa only has one arm? And I'm like,
he does.
Oh shit, I forgot. Yeah. I should have mentioned that before you walked in, not knowing how insensitive a prick you are, you know?
Jeez. Well, yeah, that's mostly Phantom Pain. The episode is not over yet because I do have some famous cases of amputees and their experiences.
I have a question.
Absolutely.
Before we get into that.
I might have an answer.
Or it's, I guess it's more of a thought. How affirming having a prosthetic could be to somebody experiencing, like, dysmorphia.
Mm-hmm.
Like, body dysmorphia
mm-hmm.
after losing a limb. And I wonder if that also helps with some of that phantom pain as well. Is yeah. when you get fitted for a prosthetic. And like you said, it, lower half, maybe not so much. Like if you were already kind of a runner, you would already, and you had a prosthetic leg, that you would be able to start running eventually. I mean, yeah. after PT and stuff and getting known, just because that's something that your body was already used to.
Yeah, I think so. I'm not too versed on that topic, but I will say that maybe the prosthetic might be equated to something that someone with, you know, body dysmorphia would do
mm-hmm.
in order to cope. I'm not exactly sure.
Yeah.
But that's a good thought, though.
Saying that the two, well, I mean, maybe comorbidly, but
mm-hmm.
yeah, but how you could probably experience some type of, just like you just don't feel like yourself, you know, mm-hmm. if you, like you said, you were an athlete and you were a runner, how, you know, losing a leg may be hugely challenging to yeah. accept, and how a prosthetic might help with that dysmorphia a little bit.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that the biggest thing is, I mean, in both instances, it's just to seek treatment, seek help, but from a professional, because
yeah.
they can help you, like, walk you through, like, yeah. what the next steps could be.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, these are not necessarily cases of phantom limb pain, but since it's so common amongst amputees, it's not far-fetched to think that these people might have been struggling with it.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not necessarily celebrities, but kind of, that have been open with their struggles of amputation or congenital amputation, which is being born without mm-hmm. a limb. So number one is Rick Allen, the drummer of Def Leppard.
Mm-hmm.
In 1984, he was racing his Corvette when he lost control and crashed into a brick wall. The accident resulted in his entire left arm being amputated, but he would relearn how to drum with one arm and continue to tour with Def Leppard, which is so cool.
Still touring.
Well, that's what we were saying just a second ago. You know, mm-hmm. someone that, I mean, you would drum with both arms, you know,
yeah.
originally, and then he lost an arm and he's like, fuck it, I'm going to still drum, you know, I'm going to figure this out.
This is in absolutely no way, shape, or form, but did you know that his Funko Pop has one arm?
What?
Yeah.
That's actually really cool.
It's cool.
I like that.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
What a badass. Number two is... Number two.
Number two, Hot 100.
Jerry Garcia.
Hmm.
He would grow up to become a founding member of the Grateful Dead.
Mm-hmm.
When he was 5 years old, he was helping his older brother chop wood when he accidentally got his finger in the way of his brother's axe. He would lose 2/3 of his middle finger, but ultimately go on to become one of the most famous guitar players of his generation.
So true.
He was also known to give his fans that middle finger during his shows.
LOL. Just a slight fuck you.
Yeah, that's funny. Number three.
Number three.
Waylon Jennings. This country music legend had his foot amputated in 2001 following a battle with diabetes. He would continue on tour, stating, quote, "Music definitely has healing powers. I was sick for a long time, and I went back to playing music, and I started getting better as soon as I did," end quote. He would unfortunately pass away the following year.
Hmm.
Number four is Frida Kahlo.
Really? What did Frida have amputated?
Shortly before her death at age 47, Frida had experienced complications following a surgery that resulted in her right leg being amputated below
mm-hmm.
the knee.
Mm-hmm.
That one, that's all I have about that one. Number five is Jim Abbott. Abbott would be born without a right hand, but remarkably would become an MLB player for the California Angels, New York Yankees, Chicago White Sox, and the Milwaukee Brewers between 1989 and 1999.
We got a badass over here.
Hell yeah. Number six, Ted Kennedy Jr., the nephew of John Kennedy, was diagnosed with osteosarcoma in his right leg when he was 12. For those of you that don't know, that's a bone cancer. And he had his leg amputated as a result. Number seven and final one is very famous, Bethany Hamilton. She's featured on the movie Soul Surfer, which is one of my favorite movies. It, well, It's about her. She's not actually in it, but it's a true story about her life.
She does it all, ladies and gentlemen.
Bethany was a very big surfer and would unfortunately lose her left arm in a shark attack when she was just 13 years old. By the time she arrived at the hospital, she had lost over 60% of her blood volume and was in hypovolemic shock.
Oh my gosh.
She would survive and would go on to continue surfing and win multiple awards.
That's incredible.
Which is really incredible. But yeah, that's all I have for today.
Very interesting. Thank you. It's a little different than what we've done in the past, but I think you're onto something. I think that's psychological. I think there's an aspect to that that has yet to be discovered or studied.
I think so too. And, you know, like I said, it's called phantom limb pain. Obviously, it's physical, but totally psychological, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And even though it is, you know, neurological and, you know, nerves... You know, it doesn't, we don't say just a diagnosis in the mental breakdown. We say, or just something we think is cool.
Or just something we think is cool, yeah. And of course, we're not medical professionals. We can't say that necessarily, but.
pushes the glasses up.
Got my finger waving in the air.
Yeah.
However.
Did you know?
Did you know? Yeah. But well, I think you're right. I think in some cases therapy works, in some cases medication works, in some cases everyone is different, and that's really incredible.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you guys so much for joining us. We hope you enjoyed this episode.
Yeah.
Join us on Thursday for another case, and then be looking forward within the next couple weeks to that extra bonus episode for our Tier 2 and 3 Patreon members at the end of the month.
Yes.
Anything else?
That's it.
Okay, we will see you next time.
All right.
Love you.
Love you.
Bye. Bye. If you want great tasting meals daily, but can't find the time to shop or even cook, we have the solution for you. Fresh Meal Plan is a convenient, easy way to create custom meals delivered right to your door. With hundreds of rotating meals each week, there's always something new to look forward to. Many of their meals are ready in 3 minutes or less, so you don't have to spend all night cooking. Just select your meals, heat, eat, and bon appetit. Click the link in our show notes today for an exclusive offer with Fresh Meal Plan and create the perfect menu for you.